Why would you do a cross-sectional when... because often research is done by people who are trying to get doctoral degrees, and so they want to do a study that they can gather all the data for right now. And the only way to do that is to do people of different ages and analyze the data, publish it, and go on about your real work after your dissertation is done. The unfortunate reality in the field of development, of human development generally, is that the majority of studies are cross-sectional or very short-term longitudinal studies. And for some of us, that's a real shortcoming of the field. So some of us encourage funding of long-term studies and get frustrated by all the crap that is published that doesn't really tell us very much. I can't say that in public. It's difficult to do longitudinal research. It's expensive. There are many studies that have been going on for decades and have the directors of the studies have been replaced. Shai's own work goes on, but he's retired. I think he's still alive, but he's retired. I'm participant in a longitudinal study that was started when I was a college freshman. And so that study was started in 1960 and is still going on. So it's 45 years later. I just got a questionnaire this summer from them, and it's a group of researchers who are looking at change during the college years. Bill Perry was part of that team, and then they're looking at the connections between our attitudes and our values and our whatever's in college and what we've done. And most of the people, we were all the same age when we started. They actually had two groups. One started in 60 and the other started in 61. And they picked up another group about 20 years later and continue. But it itself was a next wave of a study that started in the 1930s. And that's still going on. They're looking at the grandchildren of the original participants. But it's very expensive, and they've been through a number of directors. But people make their whole careers out of following those people, and they go to great lengths to chase us down. Fortunately, they're looking at a college-educated population who are really interested. But it's fun, the sorts of things that come out. This wouldn't be on the exam, but the difference between cross-sectional and longitudinal might. Because it's in the text and because I talked about it. There are fun things that you can get. One is a longitudinal study that has been done in Boston starting in the 30s. It was that original sample with some other groups added to it. And on the basis of that research, they've been able to identify a large group of alcoholic men and look at what happens to them across adulthood, and aside from finding that they die young, the researcher, a guy named George Vaillant, who's a psychiatrist at Harvard, is able to definitively say that there are only two outcomes to chronic alcoholism. You quit or you die. But he's been doing the study long enough that he can say that because people in the study either quit or die. Or they quit and then die. But that group is very small. Most of them just die of alcoholism because they don't quit. But it's an interesting... He's followed their families, followed their children, looked at what happened to their careers. It's a pretty heavy-duty and depressing study. Other questions? Am I going to... Are we going to put sample essay questions on the website again? How about you make up? Why don't you make up sample essay questions? What? You do that, don't you, now that you know the format for the exams? Should you? Could you? Sure you could. You could. Okay. I request that half a dozen of you submit to me sample essay questions and I'll put them on the web. How about that? And Julie will edit them so they are good questions. If nobody submits them, I'll have to make a couple up. But I'll bet you could make them up. The answer to your question is maybe. But if people submit sample essay questions to me, I will put those up for sure. Whether I will dig into my file and get some up, it depends on whether somebody reminds me to do that. Was it actually useful to have questions last time? Was it? Okay. I mean, that was a question I didn't ask. It really was? Okay. Yes.
How, like, throughout all the chapters, there's always something about an intelligence test. Sometimes, like, we don't need to know every intelligence test, how much about each test we need to know.
The question is, there's something in every chapter, every stage about intelligence tests. Do you need to know all of that? Probably not, but figuring out what you do need to know and what you don't is going to be tricky. I'm not concerned that you know how intelligence tests are created. I think I am concerned that you know why there are differences in intelligence test scores. What do those correlate with? And you ought to know something about the relationship of socioeconomic status, educational level, and IQ. You should have some sense of what it is that IQ doesn't measure, and how an IQ or a quantitative approach differs from a constructivist approach like Piaget. And Piaget thought intelligence tests were an interesting American kind of notion, but the idea of comparing people, he tended to question, why would you want to do that, rather than find out what they actually know. Why reduce them to a score?
Do we have to do anything with building personal profiles?
Building a personal profile of your multiple intelligences? No. I mean, not in the sense that I wouldn't ask you what your profile might look like. I would expect you to know that it's possible to create a profile and how that might be reflected in your development. You know, people with different profiles might do differently on IQ tests. They might have different responses to curriculum in school, those sorts of things. So you should have a sense of why the notion of multiple intelligences is useful and how it differs from an IQ sort of approach. It would be a fun exercise to do your own profile, but I wouldn't know how to grade it. But you ought to be knowledgeable about the fact that there is this approach out there, and what some of the intelligences and what Gardner says qualifies as an intelligence. How does a particular skill qualify as an intelligence? You ought to be able to be somewhat articulate about the relationship between brain and intelligence. So presumably, if people have different profiles, they have different brains, different kinds of brains, since each of the intelligences is based on a particular set of locations in the brain, then you have to account somehow for why performance in different areas differs, and that may be related to brain differences.
Could you go through all the cognitive, like the major points of cognitive development for each age, like adolescence, adulthood?
The question is, can I go through the major, like the characteristics of each stage? Yeah, we can probably do that. The four stages you've got pretty clear, right? Yes. Just say yes. And then make sure you do. I can't believe somebody shuffled all of my overhead. Did you do that, Julie? Okay, so you clearly should know the general characteristics of each stage, and that they don't replace each other, but as you develop, you add new skills. So that is a crucial point, that knowledge, development of understanding begins with sensory motor experience, the actions and perceptions, and that what you create are schemas of or patterns of your experience. And you continue to do that all through your life. And then as you move up into the early childhood years, you begin to learn ways of representing those schemas. So you learn words to describe them. So you know that some, in your sensory motor experience, some things are rough and smooth, and other things are smooth. Some things are wavy. Some things are sharp. You learn the words for those schemas so that you can apply the word to describe a new object when you experience it. Or when somebody tells you that something is rough, then you can anticipate how it's going to feel. That's the advantage of language, that it can help you understand before the experience what it's going to be like, if you've had similar experience in the past. And during that period, the early childhood pre-operational period, you're also learning to create longer and bigger schemas. So you begin to be able to understand multiple steps, narrative sequences. You begin to be able to tell stories that have a beginning and a middle and an end. Those are all schemas, and you're learning to create them and to represent them. You're also learning other ways of representing things, not just in words, but as the drawing the stick falling demonstrates, you can represent them graphically, you can represent them motorically, you can act things out. So you're representing the ideas that you have. And then as you move up into the elementary school years, you're becoming able to classify and categorize the experiences and to put labels on those in logical ways, in systematic ways. The text provides several descriptions of the sorts of categorization tasks that elementary school age kids become able to be. So you want to work through some of those, make sure you understand. But the big accomplishment is becoming logical about the real concrete experiences that you're having, and to be able to make your representations make sense. And then in the final stage, you're beginning to deal with abstract systems, beginning to be able to do things in your head logically. It might help if I, no, maybe it will, maybe it won't, but if I went through a typical kind of task. One of the tasks described in the text is called seriation. And it usually involves a set of sticks. And they're all, each is a different length. And the task is to, usually just throw them at the kid, dump them on the table and say, put these in order. And what you see the sensory motor kid doing is playing with the sticks, and you try to keep them from poking their eyes out and things like that. But what they're doing sensory motorly is playing with the sticks, and they're gathering the experience. And as they're doing that, they're discovering that when you move sticks around, for example, if you take this one, B, and put it next to this one, it's not as long. Gee, that's kind of interesting. Okay. This is B, I just moved it. But when I compare it, now I can see that it's shorter. And then if I take stick C and put it over here, it's not as long as B. It's even shorter. That's sensory motor experience. You're just making those comparisons. But what you're doing as you have that experience is figuring out that there are different lengths and that things look different. And you're figuring out that if you want to know whether something is shorter or longer, it's helpful if you don't have one on one side of the room and one on the other side of the room and try to figure that out. You want to put them next to each other because then you can compare. That's a sensory motor schema. If you want to compare things, put them side by side. It's a practical thing to do. As kids go up into the pre-operational period, they learn to call these sticks and they learn to describe the difference in size. If you're looking at A, B, and C, A is long, B is medium, and C is short. Oh. And you can figure out that C is shorter than B. And A is longer than C and B. So you're learning to represent what it is that you can see. You can describe it. And you're gradually figuring out how to do that in a reasonably consistent way. That long and short and medium always apply in comparative situations to length. Think about what you're going to do with them. When I tell the kid, put these in order, sensory motor kid looks at me and, you know what that means. He can't represent it. He can't make any sense out of what I've said. He's playing with the sticks. He looks at me and, put them in order. Well, he's beginning in the second year to understand the put part. So when somebody says put something, you put it away. You put it away. So the kid will follow my order, put the sticks in order. Doesn't got the in order. But he can put them, and he'll put them. And practice putting them. That's a sensory motor thing. Put them in this, put them back in the box over and over again. Take them out, dump them out, put them back in. And eventually we'll figure out that putting them in order, order is a word that must refer to something. And order means orderly. Make them orderly. So if I'm a kid at 2.5 or 3 and somebody says put something in order, it looks at me, but then how can you do that? With the sticks, I've got a sensory motor scheme that I can make to make them order. And it's likely to be this one. So they all go in the same direction. Because when I dump them on the table, then I say put them in order, the kid's going to mush them together so you can pick them up like spaghetti. Try to put them in the, remember pickup sticks, cylindrical container? Try to put them in there if you don't put them in order. If they're not all oriented the same way, they're not going back in that box. Pick up a handful of them this way, sticking out every which way. This is sensory motor kids' experience. Pick them up this way, they're sticking out everywhere. Try to put them in the cylindrical container. Doesn't work. The kid begins to figure out order and putting them all in the same direction. By the time the kid is 4 or so, the kid has figured out that these are different lengths. Some are short, some are long, some are medium, some are yellow, some are blue, some are pink, whatever you've got, can describe those and can begin to organize them in a systematic way. So you put them in order, and this is my favorite experience. I've got them in order, and I've even got them in order from shortest to longest. Isn't that neat? Don't worry about the other end. Don't worry about the other end. The 4-year-old can see one end, but not both ends. And as I move up toward concrete operations, this task becomes a lot easier because I know that having them in order means holding one end constant. And this means that I've ordered them. I've made a series, a graduated series. That's why we call it seriation. So as the kid, and this is a pretty simple task, but as the kid gets up into concrete operations, the kid can keep the end straight, compare them, eventually put that together. And then, same instruction, same sticks, put them in order another way. Can you do that? Put them in order another way. Order still means to kids that I need to have the ends in a sequence. I need to have them from shortest to longest, and concrete operational kids will tell you, okay, you mean from shortest to longest. Yeah, but do it a different way. Well, there is a way to do that. Just assume that I've pushed these down a little bit. Okay. Now I have that. And the concrete operational kid with his categorizational ability is able to do this and recognize that she has put them in order from shortest to longest. But both ends are tapered. That's more complex. It's still logical. It's quite logical. And it requires that you be able to look at both ends at the same time. So the concrete operational kid is able to do that and recognize that it doesn't have to be straight across on one end and in order on the other end. It can be on in order on both ends as long as you're consistent. They are in order from shortest to longest. Okay. This kid is looking now at shortest to longest implies not that they're all the same at one end, but that they're consistent on both ends. The formal operational kid can do what I'm doing, which is describe the difference. That this is a more complex task than the original order that I had here. There will also be a difference in the way the kid approaches doing the task. And what you see is that as kids are younger, they need to compare each one in order. And as they get older, they can group these so that if they just get one end lined up, then they can take them out and keep that order on one end and switch them around until they've got it the same on the other end. So they're dealing with the task in a more fluid way. It's more coordinated for them intellectually to do that. What Piaget's tasks all include, every single one of them, is the kid at the sensory motor level either being able to deal with the stimuli, like the test tubes and beakers, having lots of fun breaking glass and pouring liquid back and forth, then being able to represent it in some way, and then gradually increasing or constructing increasingly complex schemas that allow you to organize the task and to understand the task in a different way until it gets to the point where it becomes obvious to the kid. But you can take any of his tasks and do that kind of analysis on them. The chemical combinations, for example, is one of three or four tasks in a book called The Origins of... No, it's the one by Inhalder and Piaget, Intellectual Development in Childhood and Adolescence. Takes those three tasks, I think it is, it's either three or four, and gives them to kids from preschool up through. And the whole book is analyzing the stages, the progress in kids' ability to see the task differently and construct a different way of going about it. And each one is more complex. I'm sorry. Invisibility? Oh, their abilities. Well, he looked at his own kids from birth on. So what he describes with sensory motor intelligence is the beginning of the reflexes that kids are born with and the sensory motor skills. And he observed for each of his three children everything he could about what they were understanding about the world. And he describes that in his first three or four books. Because the sensory motor skills we're born with, and the reflexes to act on the world we're born with. And it's those that we begin putting together, the experience from those create the initial schemas that we then build on and make more and more complex and eventually represent and make more and more complex. But his radical argument is that everything starts at birth, and that you can take it back, you can deconstruct whatever you know and go back to whatever the reflexes were, what your earliest sensory experiences were that got built up into that complex understanding. And his descriptions of his kids' experience is really fascinating. Yeah. What cognitive skills are required to play soccer well? Any soccer players? Yeah? What do you need to know? What? Which way you want to kick it? Yeah. So there's a whole spatial... that's a great place to start. Where's the field? And it has two ends. And there's a goal at each end. And there's this ball. And your task is to propel that ball into the goal, your own goal. And that's occasionally a problem, you know, inadvertently kicking it in the wrong goal. Happens more in some other sports, but you have to have a spatial map of the field. How many teammates do you have? 10? 11 on teams. So you've got 10 teammates, and you've got 11 opponents. And what position do you play? Center half? Where's that on the field? You have to be able to connect each position to a specific area of the field and a specific function of each strategy. Think about the strategy for getting the ball from your end of the field to the other end of the field. And watch what happens when 5 and 6 and 7 year olds play soccer. Right? One kid gets the ball. Then what happens? That kid tries to take it down to the goal, regardless of his position. And the other team, all 10 of them, converge on that player. So they don't get the fact that the team, in fact, is composed of people who are staying in the same place, relative to the same place, and your job is to advance the ball, not to make a goal yourself. But that's a really hard concept. It's the same concept that kids stumble over in every other game that has a field. Ice hockey, field hockey, football, rugby, baseball, you know. I love watching kids play baseball because, you know, the ball goes out and 3 outfielders and 2 infielders converge on the ball. And it doesn't matter whether there are runners on base or what else they're supposed to be doing or who they're supposed to relay it to. They're going to catch the ball. So there's a whole gigantic scheme that is the game, and positions, and more complex schemes which are strategy. And then there are the sensory motor awarenesses of which direction does the ball go, and if it goes up when you kick it, you calculate the trajectory and know where it's going, and that's a cognitive skill. Where is it going? Where do I need to be in order to intercept the ball? If I've got 2 players running down and I'm between them, how do I stay between them to intercept the pass that one of them is going to make to the other one? So there's this whole huge list of things that you have to understand in order to play it well. Yeah, it's clearly much more But you can figure it out. You can think about what do you have to know in order to be able to play it well. And then if you're watching kids develop, you can see them gradually get, piece by piece by piece, what they need to know in order to stay in their position, to anticipate the ball, to figure out the strategy that they're playing against, to figure out where they need to send the ball. Because you don't kick the ball to your teammate. You kick the ball to where your teammate ought to be going. If you kick your ball to your teammate, then your teammate has to sit there and wait for it. But that doesn't advance the ball. So you have to know a pattern that you can expect your teammate to follow. So, you know, if somebody holds up three fingers, you're going to do particular things, depending on what kind of signal system you're using. That signal says, we're going to advance the ball this way, in a particular style of moves, a particular series of moves. And that means that if you're doing what you're supposed to do, the ball is going to be way out ahead, just the right amount, your teammate. So you have to know how fast your teammate can run. You have to anticipate where the opponents might be and where can they get to. So you're kicking the ball so that your teammate can get it, but the opponents can't. That means you're calculating two trajectories or three trajectories all at the same time. And then calculating the trajectory, the power of your kick and the direction of your kick to get it to the right place. I don't know how anybody manages to play this game, and it probably explains why I don't. Is most of the exam on kids and adolescents, the majority of it is, yeah, definitely. We've talked a lot more about it, and there's actually more material in the book on childhood and adolescence than there is on adulthood. But that doesn't mean we're not going to ask the questions about adulthood. We definitely will. Just that more of them will be about children and adolescents. Right. In language development, I made a decision earlier that I wasn't going to have time to do everything I wanted to do in basic cognitive development, so I skipped a major chunk of language development. There is some material in the book on language development that is appropriate and will be on the exam. The stuff that's on the website on language development, there's an overhead about Chomsky, that won't be on. I'm going to lecture about that next week. Right. Yeah, how children, except what's in the text. But there wasn't any lecture material about language, so that won't be there. But I'm not skipping language, I'm just putting it off till after the exam.
Is there anything you need to know about
About Wilson's speech? No, that was yep. That was just, you need to hear this guy. And people who are in 161 needed to understand it, but that's not for here. No, I wouldn't ask any questions about him.
A couple of the focus questions asked about the process and content of thinking and what they are and how they're related to how they develop. And I was wondering what we're supposed to understand about the process and content.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What do you understand? The focus questions are about the process and the content of thinking. And I asked whether both change across development and if they're different. We use different processes for thinking about different content. That's the way I asked that, I think.
Yeah.
Right. So, as we've talked about the process, I would argue that it's a constructive process and that it simply gets more complex, but it's basically the same process from sensory motor development of schemas to through adulthood, that we're using the information that we have, we're constructing schemas, we're putting those schemas together, the complexity of it increases. And I guess I would also argue that part of the process is representation of the schemas that we know. So we add that, we add the process of representation somewhere along in the second year. Content clearly changes what we can think about, what we do think about, sensory motor experience, and then represented experience in words or pictures or graphic representation. And then the content becomes more, again, more abstract as we move up into adolescence. You could also address that question by looking at Shai's seven stages, that the content changes as our situation changes, as we become more responsible or have more opportunities to make decisions, then what we think about changes. So the content would change as our situation in life changes. Yeah. Well, the question is whether you should know Shai's seven stages. You've got to recognize them. You probably don't have to put them in order, but you should know generally what people are doing with their minds across adulthood, as he described it. And the seven or eight intelligences that Gardner describes, it would be ideally you would have a sense. I wouldn't ask you to name all eight of them, but being able to recognize some of them would be useful. The question is, my intent in having you do the problems on the problem set that I gave you. We did talk about a fair number of those on Monday. What I hope you carried away from that was a greater awareness of how you go about solving problems, and from the illustrations, the connectedness of the sensory motor experience and the linguistic experience, and then the logical and eventually the abstract, with some idea about what kids in the preschool years are going to do, what kids in the elementary years or childhood are going to do, and then why for some of those tasks you don't get to a sophisticated performance on them until adolescence. And it's because they require dealing with the comparisons of abstract relationships, the isomorphisms. So hopefully they gave you some examples of sort of typical tasks and how kids would differ in how they dealt with them. The differences between the multiple intelligences approach to thinking about thinking and the IQ approach. The IQ approach wants to quantify your particular abilities. And typically use that to predict in performance in some way. It's a measurement approach. And what the IQ... I'm trying to restrict my answer to the sort of discussion that's in the text rather than go off on my own rant. The quantitative approach is an attempt that tries to look at individual differences. And looks for differences in test performance that relate to the test developer's theory about what differences are important. And that's an arguable point. What differences are important? And it is typically an approach that ignores development. It's typically an approach that doesn't deal with how intelligence is developed. The multiple intelligences notion that Gardner gives us is one that tries to tie intellectual performance to the brain and differences in intellectual performance to differences in the brain, and is less concerned with measurement, although that's one of his criteria, is that you can measure difference, but he's not interested in declaring that one person is higher than the other. What he's interested in is differences that are much more complex in the kinds of ways that we're different from each other. And another related difference is that some of the IQ people have broken intelligence down into anywhere from three or four components to, I think Thurman ended up with something like 45 or 50 different aspects of intelligence. But that was based strictly on the kinds of tasks that he could work into a test. And he made no attempt to connect it to the way the brain works. And what Gardner has done is say, let's look at the way the brain works and what is valued in societies and describe intelligences that way. So there's some connectedness to development.
Okay. So basically what you said, working with intelligence, just with what they're
well, but also you can measure musical skill. You can measure differences in the kinesthetic intelligence. Now there are ways to do that. It's a challenge. It's much easier to look at mathematics and verbal skills. But you can, one of his criteria is that you can define and measure differences between people in them. So you can talk about what an expert performance is, and you can measure differences. But the measurement is not his particular... That's not the only criteria. In Gardner's multiple intelligences. In the IQ approach, measurement is everything. That's what you're after, differences among people. The Sternberg? Sternberg is one of the people who has looked at the development of intelligence, and he's sort of taking, he's critical of the IQ approach, but he's saying that what the IQ test often measures is what he calls the, I think he calls it, I'm not going to use his language right, but there's a computational ability. And let me use his language, I guess. It's not computation. It's my translation. The word he uses is componential. He's looking at the components of thinking, and he means by that the critical skills, analysis. And that's what he says that we do when we do critical thinking. We take things apart, we put them back together, we recognize principles, and that's what we're trying to teach in college. And it's often what an IQ test is partly looking at. But IQ tests are often reflecting speed and recall, memory. Do you know this stuff and can you use it very quickly to put things together? And he says, then you also have, in his view, the experiential part, which is I don't like his words. That's why one of the reasons I'm not being particularly clear about it. But I don't think the experiential part, I don't think that word means what he means, which is really insight. He's talking about what we don't teach, but what people know from experience. Being able to understand something. It's sometimes he uses the term intuitive. Now, we understand the schemas that we use, but we may not be able to articulate them, but we use them. And he calls that the experiential or insight component or aspect of intelligence. And he says both of those are important in solving problems. That sometimes you just need to grasp the problem and you may not know how you got there. And some people are much better at that than others. They can look at the big picture, leap to an understanding of it, come up with an analogy for it, put it together. And other people are much better at the systematic analysis of things, what he calls the componential, the critical analytic skill. And if you're engaged in a big project, you want both those people on your team, because you want the person who's got the big picture and you've got the person who's able to crunch the numbers and do it systematically. And then the third aspect that he talks about is the contextual or practical. And that's the part of thinking where you understand whether something is going to work or not. Is it similar to previous experiences that you've had? Is it efficient? Is it worth doing? The fact that you can do something doesn't make it necessarily worth doing. And he says there are people who are better at that. But he says all of us do all three. It's sort of a multiple intelligences idea, but not quite the same. It's not brain-based. He just says if you look at the way people solve problems, some people are good at crunching the numbers and doing the logical analytic stuff. And we also do the insightful stuff of figuring out what something means. And we also have to make decisions about whether something is practical or efficient or literally worth doing within the context that we're in. So it's different aspects of the problem, and different people prefer to operate in different ways. But some people have all three of them, and they can step back and say, okay, here's what I think the problem is. If that's the case, then we need to analyze it this way. But before we do that, we need to figure out if this is worth doing. It's an interesting approach, but it doesn't have anything to do with development. Yeah, probably. No, I wouldn't ask an essay about that because I didn't talk about it in class. And the text provides very little. It's a different way of looking at use of intelligence and problem solving. And you think about people you know. You probably know people who are really good at the experiential insight part, and they may be very creative and very artistic and come up with great, wonderful new ways to do things. And you probably know people who like to slog through the details. They're in engineering. And you probably know people who are really good, practical thinkers. No. This is an important thing for me to do, and this isn't. I'm sorry. Come again? Differentiation and integration. Yes, absolutely, certainly. Yes, because in creating schemas, you're... Yeah. Cognitive development is just full of... differentiating these according to different lengths. And then integrating the different lengths, a further differentiation and integration into a more complex scheme. Yeah. And we'll get to more of that when we talk about language, which I didn't get to. Yes. Yeah, well, the question would come along with give an example. So you'd have to pick some kind of task. And then you would need to, in that example, or in describing that example, talk about the undifferentiated state where you don't see them as different. And that would be, in this case, with the sticks, it's a bunch of sticks. And originally, at the beginning, they're not differentiated as being of different lengths. So the first step would be moving from the state of not being differentiated, not being different from each other, to understanding that they're different lengths, and you do that by figuring out, by comparing them. And then integrating them into a series that's from shortest to longest. So putting them in order is a process of integration. You could also tackle that by talking more generally about the process of creating separate schemas for different aspects of your experience and then putting them together, integrating them so that you can compare the types of experience that you've had and think about them more complexly. I'm not sure I've indicated what a complete answer would be, but it would be one that includes the undifferentiated state, the differentiation process, and then the integration into some more complex state. Brain fatigue? Me too. Yeah.
Can you just go over really quickly the different theorists that we need to know? Like from last time we were.
The theorists I want you to be able to have some basic idea of our Piaget, clearly. Gardner, Shai, Sternberg, I guess you should recognize. No, because they're not cognitive theorists. Either of them. The question was whether you needed Erickson or Freud. They're for the next unit. We're actually not going to talk much about Freud because the text doesn't. I could. It's fun. It's fun stuff. It really is fun. But Erickson is more fun. Erickson is more useful. If anybody gave me half a chance, I'd teach a course on psychoanalytic theory, but nobody here wants it. One of the several people I learned about psychoanalytic from just died this summer. A guy named Eric Holtzman. A brilliant teacher. Oh, well. These good guys just keep dropping off. Bronfenbrenner. Before you go there, is that everybody on cognitive development? Okay. That's a biological development question. The question was, occasionally people skip expected stages, such as crawling in Teresa's case, just going from not crawling to walking. I think one of the things that I said, and I'll connect this back to cognitive development, one of the things I said at the time we were looking at motor development is that kids do what works. Given the environment that they're in, given that the surfaces that they're on and whether they're slanted or whether there are stairs or whether they're slippery or whether they're carpeted or whether they're rough. And kids have to invent locomotion given their bodies and what their bodies can do. And that's it's a self-organizing system, Esther Talon said. But it's also in part trial and error. It happens that most kids spend enough time on their stomachs that they get their hands and knees under them. And if you get your hands and knees under you, you're partway to crawling. But that assumes that the surfaces that you're on encourage that locomotion, and that the surfaces you're on don't discourage it, and that you have opportunity to sit and fuss or kneel on your hands and knees and fuss and scrap over it and challenge yourself and bump your nose and all of those things. So I could imagine several reasons why a kid would skip it, and one of those would be the proportions of the body and differential strength in different parts of it. Another reason, and these are all not mutually exclusive, another reason would be the specific surface and other things that are there, the social context that would encourage or not. It's possible for parents to be present enough to pick a kid up every time the kid starts to crawl, so that crawling never really gets experienced. You don't experience it. And it may be that a kid is, by happenstance, learns to stand up faster because there are things to crawl up on, and that works. And you focus then on the task that is more challenging and more available, which is moving out on 2 feet and skipping that stage. Now, let me tie that back to cognitive development, because there are, you're not going to skip one of Piaget's stages. You may not get to formal operations. And the dividing line between concrete and formal operations pretty much is the dividing line between a mentally retarded adult and a not mentally retarded adult. An IQ of 70 for an adult, or mental age of 11, is concrete operational. If you're formal operational, you can take care of yourself. And you're going to have an IQ that's high enough that you're going to be able to do your taxes and hold a job and that kind of stuff. So the society expects formal operations, but not all of us get there. But you can't skip the pre-operational period. You can't skip concrete operations. That may be where you stop. But in content, lots of things get skipped because, again, the experience that you have in the environment you're in determines what you spend your time learning about. So your sensory motor skills are applied to the experiences you have and the ones that are the experiences that are meaningful in your environment and what other people encourage. So it's possible to develop no representations for math, for mathematical operations. You've got the sensory motor experience of numericness, number. And you may have the sensory motor stuff for being able to combine things and know which is more and which is less, and even to do a rudimentary count. But that doesn't mean you're going to be exposed to the representations of number. And if you don't get them, you don't have them. And you're not going to develop number. You're not going to develop mathematical skills. If you never are with people who speak, you don't get it. You will still represent things, but you won't represent them in a shared language. You may develop your own representational ability. So, again, what you come to understand is what you experience. And if your experience is missing particular things, they're missing. And as an example, the basis for many people's math difficulties is that they have never had the opportunity to play with materials in an organized way in an environment that encouraged the development of representations of the relationships among the objects. And that's fundamental to mathematics, and many kids never get it. That's why Cuisenaire rods were developed. It's why manipulatives are used in elementary schools and preschools, and why teachers spend time talking with kids about the patterns that they're creating among the materials that they're using. Some kids are in environments where that begins to happen very early, and they develop the foundation for mathematical thinking. But if that doesn't happen for you, algebra is going to be a big blur. It comes from some pretty heavy-duty mythology that persists in the field and is based on kids whose not crawling was probably related to some significant neurological difficulties in the first place, which also are connected to their language problems. And I would ask them for the reference. It has been. I first ran into that in graduate school in the 1960s. The two charlatans who made a very good living for a number of years were two guys named Doman and Delicato, who created a school and a curriculum for going back through the motor stages. There is a piece of development that is sometimes missing, and it's missing typically because either kids have been neglected and abused, or they have a neurological problem, or both. And they're missing significant skills and sensory motor skills. And if you go back to having those kids do some of what they called motor patterning, of creating the motor skills, you may help with some of the intellectual skills that they're missing too. Doman and Delicato created a school, charged a lot of money, sold a curriculum, trained people, never, ever published a single piece of evidence to support what they were charging thousands of dollars to do. Never did. And eventually were shut down because people kept saying, excuse me, you have an ethical responsibility to document the success of your program. It's called Truth in Advertising. And they never did, and they were eventually shut down. But it persists, and I'm not sure why it persists. I've never seen a kid who was biologically normal who couldn't crawl, even if the kid didn't crawl. And there are kids who don't swim either. Even though there's a swimming reflex, and if you throw newborns in the water, they'll do it. And you can demonstrate that. Kids swim, and if you do that, kids become pretty good swimmers. After they drown a couple of times, they become pretty good swimmers. I mean, you have to pull them up when they have to learn not to breathe underwater. But that's okay. But kids who don't learn to swim don't seem to have any major cognitive problems. So I've never been sure why people focus on crawling. I don't get it. But so I'd ask for their references. What?
We forgot Perry.
We forgot Perry. Oh, yeah. Do know Perry. Yeah, thank you. That's why we pay you the big bucks. Yeah. Okay. Have a great time studying.